The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In February of last year, I sat down with Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. He was serving as House manager for the second impeachment of Donald Trump following the insurrection of January 6th. It was a time of unbelievable turmoil for the nation and for Raskin himself. He'd just lost a son to depression and suicide. On January 6th, his daughter and his son-in-law had gone with him to the Capitol, and they ended up trapped in an office, barricaded against the mob. Raskin has been serving as a member of Congress's January 6th committee, a committee that's trying to change the minds of Americans who still believe in Donald Trump and his colossal attempt at national deception. I spoke with Jamie Raskin right after their final scheduled hearing. Congressman, in the last hearing, we were shown how the president sat for hours watching television as a mob that he'd incited tried to stop the election. What have you accomplished with these hearings overall, and what's ahead for the committee?
Our assignment under House Resolution 503 is to define the events of the 6th, define what the causes were, but then to map out a series of legislative responses to them to fortify American democracy against coups, insurrections, political violence, and other attempts to usurp the will of the people. So we're still in the middle of our work. We're hoping that we're moving into the final phase of it, but we still do have investigative leads and lines of inquiry that we're going to pursue. And then we have to make these recommendations, and we don't have a lot of time to do it in.
What is the time limit, and why is there a time limit? Is it the election?
Well, there's a time limit because the House of Representatives, unlike the U.S. Senate, is a non-continuous body. All of us are up for election every 2 years. And so every time when we come back and create a new Congress, we have to adopt a whole new set of rules. We have to adopt a whole new set of committees and subcommittees and so on. So we're like, the Cinderella's gown and slippers. When we get to the end of this Congress, we're done for. It's over for us.
So much so that if the Democrats lose the House to the Republicans, I believe you can expect counter investigations, counter hearings, all kinds of political backlash, don't you think?
Well, perish the thought that's the premise of that question. But yeah, I mean, they are saying that if they get the House back, and we know that they're measuring the drapes, they don't seem to have noticed that the entire country is in an absolute backlash against their extremist right-wing politics and what the Supreme Court has done to the rights of women and men and families. So I think maybe they've jumped the gun in terms of, appointing Marjorie Taylor Greene to this or that committee and so on.
You say that with some confidence to face those elections, but I want to know to what degree you think the picture that you are painting, the facts that you're accumulating, have penetrated a wider audience than, the people that also watch MSNBC or maybe are listening to us now. Is it penetrating independence? Is it changing minds?
The polling data that I've seen about this, and I haven't zealously, hunted it all down, but the stuff that people have sent me shows that the vast majority of Democrats, 95%, understand that the big lie is a lie. It was not a stolen election, and the insurrection was an insurrection, and Donald Trump was behind it. Some more than two-thirds of independents also understand that the big lie is a lie. They understand that Donald Trump has tried to wage war against our political institutions and our constitutional order. And increasing numbers of Republicans are getting the news. I'm seeing. I mean, a political party cannot last, especially a minority political party like the Republicans, if they're going to lose 20 or 25 or 30% of their people. I mean, Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney and Adam Kinzinger and, you know, the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach and the 7 Republicans in the Senate who voted to convict, they represent some people. They represent millions of people. And that was back when we knew a lot less about what exactly Donald Trump had done. So the truth is a resilient and irrepressible thing. I think that the truth is beginning to permeate every level of the media, despite the attempt by Fox News and the right-wing media to sweep everything under the rug. But, you know, I've been accused of being an optimistic rose-colored glasses guy, but I just have to believe that the lie cannot last.
You mentioned Liz Cheney, and not so long ago, I would not have imagined you and Liz Cheney as political bedfellows. Tell me about your relationship with her now.
Well, I should start by saying, David, I've always liked Liz Cheney very much. We arrived in Congress the exact same year. We both won in 2016. We came in 2017. We have a lot in common. We're both lawyers. We're both kind of family people. We're not into that cocaine orgy scene that we've heard so much about from some of our junior Republican colleagues. And I take her to be a very serious, thoughtful person. And she's a constitutional patriot. And she's really funny. And we're able to have a lot of fun together, you know, even as we are trying to defend our constitutional order. I think that, you know, Liz, like all of us, is on a political journey. She is standing up for freedom. And obviously, and most importantly, she is standing up for the truth in this investigation and insisting upon and demanding that the country, and specifically her political party and her political party leadership, deal with the truth.
She's dealing with the truth, Congressman, and she is likely to lose and probably lose badly in her home state, in her congressional race, as you know.
Well, we don't know that to be the case.
The numbers are bad. And I'd like you to describe for us your view of, or disappointment with, or worse, about the general Republican Party, who seems either to be in lockstep with Donald Trump and what you're calling the big lie, or they're just so afraid to lose their own seats that they, you know, muddle along.
Well, you know, the original generation of Americans, the founders of the country, understood the dangers of partisanship and people getting into a partisan mentality where they begin to act increasingly cultish and they elevate party loyalty and discipline above critical thinking. And, you know, Democrats have done that, too. I mean, you know, in the wake of the Me Too era, I think a lot of Democrats would probably be nervous about somebody going back and looking to see what was being said when Bill Clinton had his various issues. I mean, I'm trying to demonstrate some even-handedness here. I mean, any of us who get into a political party can put blinders on to things that would upset us very much if we saw it happening in the other party. Now, we're obviously dealing with an extreme example here when you're talking about a president of the United States who wages war against our constitutional republic. And that's extreme. And it obviously represents the convergence of a lot of very scary political strains in America and around the world today, of authoritarianism, of racism, of anti-Semitism, of illiberalism, which a lot of the right-wing Republicans are openly praising now in somebody like Orban in Hungary or Putin in Russia. So that's alarming to me. We have to expose that. But the reason I see our hearings as opening up a huge olive branch in the country is that we've been very clear that Donald Trump knew his big lie was a total lie. It was an effort to deceive. But there were millions of people who fell for it who did not understand that it was a lie.
What role do you expect Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice to play going forward?
They should play a role of justice and of an independent law enforcement function.
And vis-a-vis Donald Trump, do you expect to see action against him?
Well, as a citizen, I would hope and expect to see action because Donald Trump is guilty as sin and the whole world can see it. But I try to be careful not to be browbeating the Attorney General of the United States and the Department of Justice. And the Attorney General, secondly, also happens to be a constituent of mine. And I don't beat up on my constituents. But I think that the great women and men of the Department of Justice, they know crime. They will prosecute a case if there is a predicate of sufficient probable cause. They will bring a case before a grand jury if the offense is sufficiently grave. It's hard to imagine a graver offense than this one. And if we want to deter people in the future from committing the same kinds of offenses.
What are you hearing from Trump voters in your district who maybe they're not going to vote for you, but you certainly have interactions with them?
I hear from lots of Republicans who say they can't take it anymore, and they're either becoming independents or they're becoming Democrats. I hear from veterans on pretty much a daily basis say, this is not what I fought for. This is not what I signed up for. And if, you know, I ever acted the way Donald Trump acted, I would have been court-martialed and I'd be spending the rest of my life behind bars. So a lot of people in the military are appalled and outraged by Donald Trump's outrageous betrayal of his oath of office.
You were at the center of impeachment and now these hearings. Have you personally learned anything about Donald Trump as a human being that you didn't know in 2016?
Well, he is never, ever to be underestimated. He uses all of the resources at his disposal, which are vast in terms of money and political power, fear and intimidation, to get his way. And you can never count him out. So he was the mastermind of all of those events. And lots of people that he activated and set into motion were only privy to parts of them. So there are obviously ridiculous and absurd things about him that people like to make fun of. But I'm not really in that camp. I'm somebody who takes him extremely seriously. And I think he continues to be a very serious threat to our constitutional order and the rule of law in America.
Last time we spoke on this program, about 18 months ago, you predicted that Trump would become a pariah in this country because of the actions he took on January 6th. How confident are you that this is happening?
I believe it is happening. Things are moving in the right direction, but the truth will make him a pariah. You know, the Republican Party has a fateful existential question to face. You know, do they want to double down on this? And it has nothing to do with the truth. It's got nothing to do with the Constitution. It's just operating out of pure political fear and cowardice and subordinating themselves to the will of the alpha guy. It's amazing to me that he's a figure of partisan loyalty when he wasn't even a Republican for a long time. He was a pro-choice Democrat. He even wanted to run for president on the Reform Party. I mean, he's just a hustler and a con man. And it's remarkable to me that grown adults, people even in his age group up in their 60s, 70s, 80s, wrap themselves around the lies.
What prevents him from doing that again?
Oh, well, I'm sure he's going to attempt it again. And of course, he will strike the pose of a populist again. The billionaire from Manhattan, who has nothing but contempt for the people that he's willing to send into battle against the police, will again try to strike a populist pose. I have no doubt about that. That's the ticket for him. I mean, he's going to try to continue perpetrating this fraud on the American public for as long as people are willing to buy it. And that's why I always go back to the founders. They understood that perfectly. If you check out Federalist Number 1 by Alexander Hamilton, he talked about people like Donald Trump who have no respect for the constitutional system and are willing to begin as demagogues, pandering to the ugliest prejudices and passions of the crowd, but then end up as tyrants, destroying everybody's freedom. I like to say that Donald Trump doesn't understand anything about the founders, but they understood him perfectly.
Right now, his biggest competitor for the Republican nomination, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but we know it's true, is Governor DeSantis in Florida. How does he resemble or not resemble Donald Trump?
Well, at this point, Donald Trump is a little bit less of a problem than Trumpism, because he's created the formula for dangerous extremist politics on the right wing. And DeSantis is not challenging Trump on anything substantive. He just wants to knock him out of the way. He shows the exact same kind of authoritarian politics that Trump does, pandering to racism, homophobia, immigrant bashing, you name it. So I think that it will be some level of progress for Trump to be exposed and discredited and removed one way or another as a threat to the Republic. But that's not remotely the end of it if Trumpism is alive and well and you have, you know, political leaders who adopt a position of no enemies on the right and are willing to incorporate the most vicious, racist, anti-Semitic, authoritarian, neo-fascist groups in the country.
Considering all you've said and the danger of that, is Joe Biden too old to be a second-term president? Should the Democratic Party be thinking about looking elsewhere?
I don't think it's a question of his being too old. I think that people in our caucus are very supportive of all of the accomplishments that President Biden has had, and I've got a lot of admiration and affection for Joe Biden.
And you think he's up to the job 2 years down the line and 4 years hence?
Well, and you know, that's the question that he's got to ask himself. And that's a question all of us have to ask ourselves, because this is not what everybody bargained for. And, you know, whether he is up for this struggle against the dangerous extremists who have taken over the Republican Party. And I noticed that some people are saying, you know, it's time to do some other stuff. I mean, this is tough, hard work every day to go in and to fight people with this authoritarian, autocratic mentality, and people who are willing to lie directly in your face, and people who are willing to spread propaganda and disinformation and to engage in, you know, ugly ad hominem tactics against people. So all of us have to ask ourselves, you know, are we up for this fight?
Congressman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, David.
Jamie Raskin serves on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol. He represents Maryland's 8th Congressional District. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, here's a headline from last Monday morning. Extreme heat baking U.S. likely to linger into weekend.
Well, a little bit of concern, obviously, because this is just the beginning of what we think is coming to pass, you know. And now here we are.
Because this isn't getting, it's not going to get any better. You know, before it gets worse, it's like we got to wake up. You know, so hopefully the future, our children,
well, they're smarter than we were.
They definitely smarter than we are. And were at their age.
There's one advantage they have.
Yeah. So, absolutely. Well, you stay cool.
All over the world, people are figuring out how to cope with temperatures that are becoming truly unlivable. London reached 104 degrees recently. Portland, Oregon last week, 102. And on the plains of Texas, it was 110 or higher.
So I have morning tasks, anything that requires thought or that I know is going to be a little more difficult mentally, first thing in the morning. And then the afternoon, hopefully you know where to work in the shade.
Recently, our contributor Dhruv Kular was in India. The capital, New Delhi, hit 122 degrees this year. Schools and businesses changed their hours or closed entirely. Birds fell from the sky.
I have family in India. My parents are from India. And so I had always gone back over the years to visit family who still live there, my aunts and uncles, cousins.
He says that every time he visits India, it feels hotter than the last time. Dhruv Kular is also a practicing physician at a hospital in New York, and he's looking at the effect of extreme temperatures on our bodies.
There's the obvious things that you might think about, like heat stroke and dehydration, but there's so many other ways that extreme heat affects people's health, whether it's cardiovascular disease or respiratory disease. And so what I really wanted to do was take a trip in the middle of this heat wave and figure out what it was like on the ground. The sun is beating down. Even at this hour, we're here early in the morning, it's already 93 degrees. It's expected to rise another 10 or 15 degrees later in the afternoon. When I go to India, it is a type of heat that I almost feel like I never experience here. It is kind of scorching hot. It's often very humid. You kind of feel like you have to be inside in air conditioning as much as possible. And you also recognize that most people don't have that opportunity in India. So when it gets really, really hot, that's a very different calculus in India than it is in the United States.
In fact, India has reported 4 heat waves since the beginning of summer. And its capital, New Delhi, is now dealing with a fire that has been raging on for 30 hours now at the Bhalsua landfill in the northern part of the capital.
So, you know, March was one of the hottest months in the history of India, and then April was one of the hottest months in the history of India. And on April 26th, this huge landfill on the outskirts of Delhi, it's on the outskirts of Delhi, but it's only about 15 miles from the seat of the Indian government, it caught fire.
As a landfill burned outside the capital Wednesday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi warned the country is getting too hot too soon.
And, you know, landfills are known to catch fire. They do from time to time. There's a lot of toxic fumes and gases. But this extreme heat created a massive fire that firefighters couldn't put out for basically weeks.
More news from Delhi. Well, after the Ghazipur Mandi, the Bhalsua landfill unit in North Delhi is the one that has caught fire. And this has been happening for the last 4 days or so with residents living in this area.
And then the toxic fumes and the heat of the landfill itself affected a lot of people's health in terrible ways. I mean, people were having trouble breathing. People were having trouble thinking clearly. People suffered burns. And so it was a really kind of severe and dire example of what, you know, these types of extreme temperatures can inflict on a community. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to go and see it for myself. So we're standing here at the Bhalsua landfill. It looks like a mountain from afar. I thought it was a mountain, but when you get closer, you see rags, you see bottles, you see all sorts of trash. There's a few areas where the landfill, which was on fire a few weeks ago, still seems to be sending off fumes. A lot of people actually make their livings at these landfills. And so what they're doing is collecting the trash, they're storing the trash, they are selling it to people who are then recycling the trash. I see not just children, but older people. Some folks are taking carts, wagons down the street to try to take what they can. Not just these trucks that are driving up and dumping, whatever trash that they wanted to dump there. There are people that live there. There are schools nearby. There are people who come from other cities just to work at these landfills. I saw a gentleman just walk by with what looked like a cart full of lemons that he was going to sell. They're often called waste pickers or rag pickers, but in India, it's very common that that people make their living at these landfills. So I went to landfill with two NGOs that support people who work at the landfill, and we walked down this kind of alley into a brick hut. These huts that line the path to the landfill. Outside of one, I saw a man who was kind of knotting human hair that he'd collected at the landfill, and his intention was to sell them as wigs. I walked into one of these huts, and there were five or six women. And they were all dressed in kind of very colorful clothing, and they were really eager to kind of tell their story and their experience, both with the fire, but also with the heat, and generally the challenging working conditions that they endure every day.
Mera naam Saravanu hai aur main Nelfil ke paas hi rehta hu. To jaise hum log kavada in logo se khareed lete.
There was a woman named Saira who was kind of the local boss, and she she was standing in the corner. She was dressed in kind of a blue and red sari with her head covered. She answered most questions that I asked that I asked the group, and she, you know, she had a lot to say. Her parents are from Calcutta, and after they got married, they moved to Delhi. Saira and her siblings were all born in a kind of a poor area of Delhi. She says one of the reasons that she stayed in Delhi was that in the villages, they don't have these large landfills. Whereas here at the Balsava landfill, she was able to make a living. She was able to educate her children. She was able to kind of scrap together a way of life that just wasn't possible back in her village. One of the things that they told me is that it's really hard to work in the summer because of the extreme heat. So in the winter, even if parts of the landfill are on fire, they're able to wrap themselves, wrap scarves around their faces or, protect themselves and are able to continue working. In the summer, that becomes really, really difficult. Some of the women try to drape a shirt over themselves, drape a shirt over their head. That makes them feel even hotter. They take water up to the landfill, and it becomes so hot, almost like boiling by the time that they're able to drink it. So it's a really challenging situation. So, Saira told me, up until a few years ago even, she felt like it was possible for people to comfortably work on the landfill. But she said that it doesn't feel that way anymore. They're having to really change their schedules. They're not able to work on the landfill during the day. So a lot of them go up there in the middle of the night, and that's when they have to work. It's the only time that is tolerable to work. Some of the women told me that they sleep up there, that they eat up there. So being outside in the sun, in the direct heat, all day long, as you can imagine, has kind of a terribly damaging impact on the body. You know, these women were suffering from dehydration, from headaches, from exhaustion, rashes, fevers, you know, the smell of the garbage. It was sickening, but they couldn't even tolerate masks because it was so hot. You know, some of the people who already had respiratory issues when the fire started, they weren't even able to get out of bed because it became so difficult for them to breathe. Question where they go when they have these types of symptoms. Is there anywhere they can get medical care? And they told me there wasn't. Sometimes they pool together their money and they go to a local pharmacy to buy a medication that they think might help. But really, they have almost no access to medical care. You know, we've talked a lot about the physical health effects of extreme heat and extreme weather, but, you know, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has recently highlighted the mental health effects. And I think that's something that we don't talk enough about. I mean, if you have an underlying mental health problem, that could spiral out of control because of some of these events. But also people who suffer from, you know, a hurricane or a drought or a wildfire, there's tremendous after effects in terms of your emotional and your mental well-being that could last for months or even years after that. You know, we tend to think of this as a problem that will affect predominantly low-income countries or middle-income countries, but climate change has inflicted lethal heat, you know, right here in the United States as well. Heat waves kill more Americans than any other extreme weather event, and that is going to get more and more common in the coming years. So we need to take the steps now to prepare for that. You leave with this feeling that people are amazingly resilient, that they adapt to their circumstances, that they can go through a lot and still make a life for themselves. But also, at some point, it becomes too much. And I think we're approaching that point where even the most resilient people, the type of lives that they have to live because of the effects of climate change, that's not going to be sustainable for very much longer.
Dhruv Kular practices at Weill Cornell Medicine, a hospital in New York. And you can find his reporting from India and all his writing on COVID-19 and other subjects at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We spoke earlier about the heat waves facing much of the world this summer. And in even the most optimistic scenarios, climate change will continue to worsen for years to come. So unless you're truly committed to denying reality, you may be asking, how are we going to live with this? How can we live with this? Daniel Sherrill has been wrestling with these questions for most of his life. He's a climate activist and an author, a millennial born in 1990. Sherrill's recent book is called Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of the World. He talked with our producer, Gofen Mputubwele.
I came across Daniel Sherrill's book, Warmth, last year. And the premise of the book is this. He's a climate activist, and so he's writing a book to his future potential child. Like a lot of people that I know, he's like, is it ethical to have a kid when they're going to grow up in a climate disaster? And so this book is a letter to that future kid talking about the present that we live in now. And somehow I feel like the book creates space for me to sort of think about the state of the planet, like emotionally, in a way that I normally wouldn't. Here's an excerpt from his book. It was in the early 2010s that the storms began to feel like more than just weather. They'd become semi-routinized by now. Another way to mark out the time. When a storm made landfall, footage would flash for days across every screen in the country. The more catastrophes I witnessed, the more a pattern began to reveal itself. Maybe by the time you read this, Hurricane Maria will have become a footnote, its importance diluted by the accelerating chain of subsequent storms that, as of now, have yet to occur.
I grew up in the 90s. It was the end of history. Francis Fukuyama had declared we would all, you know, work 9 to 5 and go shopping and die, and that state of affairs would be basically stable forever. And my father, who's an oceanographer, would and did a lot of research in Antarctica when I was growing up, would come back and sort of share with me, like, there was this thing happening down in Antarctica that would eventually come for the rest of us, where the planet that we'd assumed was a sort of stable premise of our short little lifespans was in fact going through like pretty fundamental upheavals. And that was a very strange thing to learn about as a small child, you know, 8 or 9, to be like, okay, that seems like quite a big deal, but I don't see anybody around me talking about it, let alone emoting about it. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it's just not that big of a deal after all, and I'll sort of sublimate it or bury it.
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. And I think when you do start to take on the emotion, in my experience, that can feel super overwhelming. And that sort of makes me think of the story of Noah with the flood and how it like increases little by little, like the rains and the waters are rising from the deeps and all of that. I think of that when I start to sort of like allow myself to emote about everything that's going on, like the sheer number of things going on in the world around me.
The metaphor, you spoke about the beginning of Noah and the waters descending from the heavens and rising up from the earth. And I went to Jewish day school, K-8, so I'm familiar with the legends of Noah. And, you know, what that really reminded me, I spent a few weeks in 2019 running creative writing workshops at the university in Tuvalu, which is a tiny, tiny nation in the Pacific, one of the lowest lying island nations in the world. And they are experiencing right now exactly what Noah did. On the one hand, the seas are percolating up through the ground level so that the freshwater lens on which they rely for their agriculture, for their drinking water, is slowly getting more and more saline and basically undrinkable. So you used to be able to grow fields of taro on these islands, and you just can't grow that anymore. It's essentially a food desert. They have to ship in everything from Fiji. And then on the other hand, storms in the Pacific are getting worse, and so the rain is lashing down from above, and they're being squeezed. The emotional technologies they developed to deal with this, the sort of humor, the grit, the sarcasm, the ennui, the like pure hedonistic pleasure seeking, the mixture that they'd arrived at, I think, is something that we've yet to develop. I think there's sometimes this fantasy with the climate crisis, with racial injustice, with economic injustice, that there's going to be an end, you know, some final catharsis and the credits roll and we've either won or we lost. And that various people with various crystal balls want to, you know, they make a career out of telling you it's going to go one way or another. And I think that relieves us of the burden of having to grapple with the weight and the uncertainty every day, which I find to be one of the hardest things about this. And yet, like, walking that tightrope between those two poles of despair and optimism is, to me, like, part of my life's work as a climate organizer, is staying on that tightrope that I would call reality.
Here is an important piece of context, something I'd like you to know up front. Occasionally, amid all the storms, I'd feel grief. The grief had its own weather. It could come down like a squall, momentary and encompassing, impervious to forecast. This was a weight I kept private mostly, unsure of whether or how to share it. But alone, it rose up in me like a whale from a depth, almost invisible until the moment it breached, water streaming from its flanks, the most powerful thing in the world. And like with a whale, the breaches seemed to come at random, when I least expected them. I cried about it in line at the grocery store, and in the bathroom at parties, and by myself in the shower. Never loudly, just a few tears, messy and quickly stifled.
I wrote a deeply anti-fatalistic book, and I'm not a fatalist. But we know that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And probably, at least for the duration of my lifetime, will continue to get worse. If it gets better, it might be a few generations hence. And so how do you sustain yourself over like those coming decades, the roller coaster that we know we're already on?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm going to say this before I forget. I think that one of the things that you said that just is stuck in my brain is emotional technology. Because it does feel a little bit like the technology of our emotions as to the moment and the era that we live in, particularly for like our age, feels basic.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. You know? Totally. I mean, that's why I wrote this book, right? You know, I didn't set out to write a book. I set out first to read a book. You know, I love literature and it's like a major means of processing reality for me. And I set out to look for a book that could sort of countenance the weight of the climate crisis in the present. Rather, there was a whole body of science fiction, some of it very good, that displaced the climate crisis as a sort of a futuristic dystopian premise from which the narrative could unspool. But I wanted to, like, what does it feel like to live with it now? Like, it's happening now. But it made me feel lonely, you know, and it was the same loneliness I felt, you know, even as recently as 5 years ago. Like, if I had told somebody, I can't get out of bed today because, like, the enormity of the climate crisis is sitting on my chest, it just would have been, like, not really legible, you know? And I felt like the kinds of conversations I wanted to be having about this, which would have been a mechanism for sharing that weight, that were, like, vulnerable and honest and commiserative and confused and maybe even hopeful, like, there weren't the cultural avenues to have those conversations. And so I just spoke to myself. I mean, that's what a book is, in a way.
So I often describe it this way to people, is that, like, climate has never been one of my things, is, like, often the language that I use, right? And I think the thing that's interesting and the thing that's interesting about reading your book is that, like, it almost is because whenever it's come up, I've just been like, I don't even have a framework to deal with this in any way that's not just like, I guess it's too late. Like, I don't even have basic vocabulary. I don't have subject and verb and, like, you know. And so it, to me, it just, like, reiterates that idea of, like, the ability to conceptual, metaphysical, whatever, ability to grasp a thing or to grapple with a thing, you know.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think that's part of what I was trying to do with his book, is I realized also that I didn't have the words, and that in some ways words themselves were inadequate vessels, but I was trying to use them to arrive at a place beyond language that would essentially be like a new feeling in my set, inside myself, that could accommodate what seemed like an unaccommodatable reality of the climate crisis. So you're, but, and it's sort of funny, you know, that there's the, I can imagine the response in my head, whatever, like the Tucker Carlson's of the world, just, you know, when they hear millennial despair, it's like, okay, go cry about it, snowflake, which is kind of honestly hilarious. Right. But it's, it's also wild to me to cast us as the children here, as the immature ones here, when in fact we are trying desperately to figure out how to accommodate new realities and learn to survive, mm-hmm. while they are marching blindly into oblivion. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm gonna choose to treat this huge swath of people and this huge swath of the literal, actual, physical substrate on which we live as essentially ignorable. Like, it turns out you just can't do that without risking the whole thing, you know? Like, it's sort of like you have to actually see reality. Mm-hmm. And so part of what, you know, the climate movement, I think, is set out to do, much like the Black Lives Matter movement, is to, like, force the polity to, like, actually live in reality and see the full picture and see the full humanity of everybody and see the full tangibility of all ecosystems. And, like, it's sort of like an ontological reorientation, because I feel like capitalism has been built on this, like, narrowing of the aperture, which is what allows you to create immense violence and sacrifice zones beyond the boundaries of the aperture. And so we're just, like, trying to force it wide again. But it's really hard. My dear friend Emily and I, who's featured in the book, we've been talking recently about, especially in the wake of the Glasgow COP, about the Horcrux model of climate change. For all that, just to flip us back to middle school for a second. Bear with me. And, you know, there is a huge swath of outcomes between 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming and 3 degrees Celsius of warming, which is what we're currently on track for. When I was growing up in the 90s, when nobody gave a shit about the climate crisis, we were on track for 4 or 5 degrees of warming. That's basically like Mad Max, you know? It would have led to mass human die-off. And we still might be heading in that direction, but we have bent the curve of emissions down somewhat. And so there's this vast array of outcomes, and between 1.5 and 3, and for every tick of the thermometer between those two poles, you are saving or consigning millions of people to life and death. And so Emily and I are like, okay, there are 15 tenths of a degree between 1.5 and 3 degrees Celsius. and much like the Horcruxes, each one of those things is going to involve an almost impossible seeming political mission. And that the rest of our lives is going to be spent on, you know, probably all of my work for the rest of my life will maybe be some small part of shaving off one of those 15 tenths. Mm-hmm. But when I imagine myself behind a veil of ignorance, like not having been born yet, and somebody were to tell me, you know, you would be born in 1990, the year the first popular book on global warming would be released, you'll see it as you come of age. It'll transition from a niche research topic to an ongoing global catastrophe. Obviously, I would have felt grief about that, and I do feel grief about that. But also, if somebody had, you know, likewise told me that you're going to spend the rest of your life coming together with people who share your values to try to create a polity and economy that actually treats everybody with dignity, I kind of can't think of a more meaningful way to spend a human life.
Where is it that you land in your book? Tell me about, like, the kind of psychic, you know, spiritual, whatever ending of that you land on.
Oh gosh.
Give the like short version.
Yeah. About it, yeah. So I don't know if I arrive at like a pithy piece of advice by the end of the book, but one of the thoughts I had as I was concluding writing it was, it clarified for me what seemed to be the chief ethical and political responsibility of being alive in the 21st century, which was to pay active attention to the huge swaths of the natural and human world that the stories I was fed as a child taught me to ignore. And that stretching those boundaries of attention outward, political yeah. attention, economic attention, cultural attention, organizing attention, is the only way we're going to survive. And when I'm feeling hopeless, which I still am often, it's always something I'll be moving through. It's never something I'm going to have left behind, I think, because there's never going to be that conclusive credit roll where we've either won or lost the climate crisis. I think it's going to be a pall over my life for the rest of my life. But the fact that the path to collective survival runs through expanding our notion of who is a person and who is deserving of love, even beyond the human species. I'm sometimes overwhelmed by the beauty of that, mm-hmm. And honored to be a part of that project.
Yeah.
Even if I don't, I have no assurances it won't end in tragedy.
Daniel Sherrell's recent book is called Warmth, and he spoke last year with Gofen Mputubwele, a producer for our program. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Wu Coley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, James Napoli, Rachel Munro, and Michael Falero. Special thanks this week to Rajesh Joshi.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund. ¶¶